thermodynamics because it sort of gives, in part, an excuse to look at a wider range of black hole solutions and just to sort of talk a little bit more about the types of GR solutions that you can have, both including charge or rotation or indeed the cosmological constant. So I'm just going to start simply by adding charge. We've kind of, I think, brushed on this in passing in other lectures, but I thought it might just be useful, given some of the questions on inner horizons and so on, to just say a few words about charged black holes. So the classic charged black hole is the Riesen and Nordström solution, where that function F has this form. So you start off with the same sort of Schwarzschild behavior, and you also have a charge. So here, your electromagnetic field or your gauge field might be Q over RDT or Q sine theta, sorry, Q cos theta d phi. So if you remember when we talked about Kaluza-Klein black holes, I think I had sort of mentioned, you know, something about the gauge choices for the magnetic solution. So I'm not going to go into that in huge detail here, but I mean, this kind of refers back. So you have what you might call, what we sort of call a topological solution, because it's kind of relying, you know, this business of the gauge patching works because you've removed the origin from your coordinate system. And so this is the normal elementary charge. So your standard electromagnetism, this would be your sort of standard charge, and the, if you take the dual of the field strength of this, you get the field strength of that. So let's start by looking at what is the temperature of the black hole. Well, for that, let me just notice, F goes to zero at R equals R plus or minus. I'm just going to call this GM length scale little m, just for simplicity, save on writing. So there are two zeros of F in general, which sort of indicates these two null surfaces, but R plus tends to R minus as Q tends to M. And then for Q bigger than M, there's no horizon. So we conventionally do not consider these solutions in gravity because right from the outset they have a naked singularity. So we always stay with horizons. And then when Q equals M, when R plus equals R minus, we call that the extremal limit. And so really it's extremal because it's right at the edge of the range where we have a horizon cloaking the central singularity. So let's look now at the temperature by using the Euclidean trick. Okay. So I'll not write the explicit F. I'm going to look at this general form over here. So I'm going to note that at the horizon, F goes to zero, and at least as long as Q is strictly less than M, F goes to zero, like R minus R plus. So if I look at this, just the TR, this looks like R minus R plus F plus prime d tau squared plus dr squared over F plus prime R minus R plus. So just like when we talked about the Euclidean Schwarzschild, you see that if you choose a coordinate that's proportional to the square root of R minus R plus, that second term will look just like a distance away from the origin. So if I put in, I'm just going to tell you what the constant of proportionality is. If I choose my constant of proportionality to be 4 over the derivative of f at the horizon, then I get my standard origin in polar coordinates. And so asking that the horizon is non-singular gives me a periodicity of 4 pi over f plus prime. So let me just check, because I've derived that using a general expression, so I'll check with Schwarzschild. So if I look at my Schwarzschild metric, the derivative of Schwarzschild is 2gm on r squared, I evaluate that at r plus, and r plus is 2gm, then I get that f plus prime is 1 on 2gm, and so that's beta is 8 pi gm, which is what we had when we were just focusing on the explicit Schwarzschild. So it's always... I mean, I know that's kind of obvious, but I'm just sort of stressing that when you derive something, it's always good to pause and check. So what we've got here now is a very general expression for temperature, provided we've got that sort of setup for the metric near a horizon. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to put in what F is for Riesen and Nordström and find what the temperature is. So that's what my F primed is, but I can actually replace as I go to R plus, I'd actually do 1 over R plus. So what I can do is I can replace 2m on R plus by 1 plus q squared on r plus squared, just using the fact that f of r plus is 0. And so what do I get? I get that 2m on r is equal to 1 plus q squared on r squared. And so I end up here with 1 minus q squared over r plus squared. So my my temperature has a quite a simple form. So I've written it, rather than writing it in terms of m and r plus and q, that's three different symbols, but there's only 2 degrees of freedom, m and r plus. I've chosen to parameterize the 2 degrees of freedom by r plus and q. So noticing that essentially, as if you change r plus, so we're going to fix q and talk about what happens. So changing m changes r plus for a given q. So we just note that r plus has a lower limit, and if I just sketch the temperature as a function of r plus, notice that as q tends to r plus, in other words, as q tends to m, t goes to zero. So we have a zero of the temperature. If we look at the temperature as r plus goes to infinity, that t also goes to zero from above. So I know that I've got this coming from in from infinity, and so I know that there's a maximum temperature of my Reissner-Nordström black hole for a given q. Which is 2q on root 3. So already this is different from Schwarzschild. Schwarzschild just simply had the temperature was inversely proportional to the mass. So as the black hole radiated and lost mass, the temperature went up. And then, you know, it sort of increased without limit. And so it suggests that the black hole evaporates away. Whereas here, if you evaporate without changing charge, your temperature first goes up, but then it starts to drop. And so you would never really reach extremality by this evaporation process. Okay, so that's Reissner-Nordström. Now I want to add lambda. And I'm going to add a negative lambda, so in other words, ADS. So there's a tutorial where you explore this in more depth. But in this case, so this adds an extra piece to my f. So as before, we've got that 4πt, which is f plus primed. So what changes here, you've got, it sort of looks very similar, but this is like the new term coming from being an ADS. So what does that do to our original plot? Well, you can see that this here still has a zero. So let's... So I can still find a root of t equals zero. I can just solve this for r plus squared. So I still have something which is close to q equals zero. Sorry, t equals zero, which is close to r plus equals q. But notice here that if r plus equals q, this is still slightly positive. So it sort of shifts this zero to the left. But now, so we start off something similar. But now, when I go to r plus equals infinity, my temperature is linearly increasing. So up here, I've got an increasing T. So this is extremely different to the Schwarzschild black hole. So I'll just say a word or two about that. You're going to do it in more detail in the tutorial. But let me just pause for a moment with the discussion of the charge to just bring that out. So if you look at that, and again, I'm always quite a fan of sketching because sketching means you don't have to actually run the numbers. You get a sort of impression of the qualitative behavior of a system without having to calculate. So if I just on the side draw my little sketch of t as a function of r plus, as r plus goes to zero, t tends to infinity. But as r plus goes to infinity, t tends to infinity. And so I see that, in fact, t has a minimum. And this is really, really different to an asymptotically flat black hole. So what this is saying is that, so obviously the scale here, the scale that sets the minimum is L. And so it's saying that if black holes are really small, so anti de Sitter space is a constant negatively curved space-time where the curvature scale is set by L. So if you have a black hole that's a lot smaller than L, locally, that negative curvature is very small. It's negligible. And so you expect to see things that are very similar to flat space. And indeed, that's sort of what you see. As R plus gets smaller and smaller, the impact of this second term drops out. and you get the Schwarzschild answer. So for low values of M or R plus, you've got something that looks like the Schwarzschild black hole. But then this bizarre behavior as you make the black hole bigger and bigger, once it starts getting comparable to the curvature of the space-time, then it actually starts behaving differently. Big black holes have positive specific heat in ADS. So these black holes were explored, gosh, I want to say in the late 70s by Stephen Hawking and Don Page. And at the time, you know, the paper was very much sort of, well, you know, these are never going to be of any relevance, but gee, look at this interesting phenomenon. That sort of style, you know, in the sense of it was very much a formal investigation into the possibilities rather than thinking about it having any particular application in mind. And so it's just, you know, I guess the moral is, given just how much that paper is cited now because of its relevance in ADS-CFT, it's just quite, you know, you never know what some sort of abstract formal investigation might end up doing or having relevance for. So that's what they actually did. And what you'll do in the tutorial is that they then looked at a plot of the free energy and compared the free energy of a black hole at a particular temperature with a thermal bath, which had zero free energy. And so for, I'm trying to remember, I think for large black holes are stable, I think, whereas there's the Hawking-Page transition where actually the thermal bath is preferred over the black hole. So have fun on Thursday, I think is the moral of that one. Or is it next Wednesday? Okay, so that's just highlighting this new feature in anti-de Sitter space. So to add, if you add charge, if I go back to this original plot, I can imagine two ways of linking these two points here and here, which are just sketches, so they're kind of fictitious. I could link them directly, or I could imagine that my plot wiggles. Not quite like that, but more like that. So there's two ways that I can link those two sort of asymptotic behaviors. So let's see which is relevant. To do that, I've got to decide, does T have any turning points? So I commented that T had a turning point if you had no charge in ADS, and that was a minimum. And T has a turning point if you have no ADS but with charge, although that's a maximum. So if I take the derivative of t with respect to r plus, I get the minus 1 from the first term. That just stays as plus 3. And then the q squared p swaps sign. And I just solve this quadratic for r plus squared. So this is going to tell me whether or not T has any turning points. So clearly, if 36 Q squared on L squared is bigger than 1, there's no real solution, and therefore T does not have a turning point. However, if 36 Q squared on L squared is less than 1, then I have two roots, and therefore I have two turning points. And of course, when it's equal, I've just got an inflection point. So this term here is what's telling me whether or not I have turning points. So in order to kind of just pursue that line of thought and also to pick up on something I said earlier about free energy, I want to look at what actually happens with the thermodynamics of these black holes. So usually we want to take this first law. Okay, so we did this with Kerr, where we looked at what happens if we throw something into the black hole. What happens? So we might expect the mass to change, potentially the charge to change. And here I'm also allowing for this L parameter in the solution to change. So I'll come back to that, because I think most people, when they first see that, say, hang on, it's a cosmological constant, it can't change. It's not quite true. So let's just look here at these pieces. We know that this F plus primed is related to T. Q very directly is the charge on the black hole. M here is obviously going to be related to, in some way, to the energy in the black hole. And then if I look at this piece, this is really, it's R plus squared delta of 1 on L squared. But I said that 1 on L squared was minus lambda on 3. So when you write lambda, that's sort of thinking about lambda very much as a cosmological constant. But I can also think of it as an energy momentum. And so this is actually R plus squared. So my lambda is 8 pi g times a sort of effective energy momentum. So let me say that's minus 8 pi g. And then it is sort of an effective energy density, which is equal to and I guess since I've wrapped up the G in that M, this is now, because your cosmological constant your cosmological constant has the form of a stress energy of a perfect fluid with rho equals p, minus p, sorry. And p is minus rho. So I've just kind of done that trail of thought there. So I can rewrite this as delta m is pi t delta of r plus squared plus q and r plus delta q. So I sort of rewrite and reorder my terms. So I knew that the f plus prime had something to do with t. So I've pulled that out. And then I've obviously multiplied through by r plus on 2. So I've said that my r plus delta r plus is delta of r plus squared on 2. And so that changes the 4 pi t to pi t. And here I just end up with q and r plus when I multiply by r plus on 2. And then the last piece, that's multiplying by r plus on 2. So again, this term here is t delta s. But here, this q on r plus is the electrostatic potential at the horizon. So here, so that is like the potential term. If you want to change the charge, you're kind of fighting against a local electrostatic potential. And then finally, I can package this last term as 4/3 pi r plus cubed delta p, which I'm going to write as v delta p. So what I end up with is delta m is t delta s plus phi delta q plus v delta p. So this is my first law for this charged ADS black hole. So it's probably worth just saying a few things, because I think that there's a sort of assumption, I think, often that when you see M for the black hole, that means it's its mass or internal energy, right? But notice here, this is not, if I compare with my standard thermodynamics, du is Tds minus Pdv, that's my normal internal energy thermodynamics, right? And we don't have that here. Instead, my M is really looking like U plus PV, which is enthalpy. So you have to be somewhat careful about making assumptions about what happens if you throw things into the black hole. So this link with enthalpy was first noted by Castor and Trashen, and a really good review. On this whole topic is by your, that is your David Kubisnik. It's written by David, Rob Mann, and Theo. So a lot of the work that you see on black hole thermodynamics, particularly when you start plotting phase planes, tends to be done using these parameters from the metric. However, if this black hole thermodynamics is really sort of, you know, going to hang together as a sort of genuine expression of thermodynamics, you really should be able to write things purely in terms of the thermodynamic charges and potentials. So this is sometimes sort of called a black hole chemistry, and indeed this is the title of this review, black hole chemistry. So what do I mean by that? Well, let me just show you by actually deriving an expression, for this Reissner-Nordström ADS black hole. So if I now look at the condition for the horizon, and I've kind of been using this, I get the 2m is equal to r plus into 1 plus q squared on r plus squared plus r plus squared on l squared. Okay. But then, so in that, my Q is a charge, so I'm okay with that. My 1 on L squared, I can rewrite as a charge because I've got that 1 on L squared, if I follow this line of thought through here, is 8 pi p on 3. So I don't mind about the 1 on L squared. I do mind, however, about all these R pluses floating around, because that is something that comes from the geometry. So, let me replace every single R plus with an S on pi. So now I've got an expression for M in terms of the charges. So my enthalpy squared actually, let me call it capital M, but with a little h to notice that it's enthalpy. So in other words, I have this sort of integration, if you like, formula for my thermodynamics, where I can express this internal enthalpy of the black hole just in terms of the charges. So although it was derived in a different context, in other words, for asymptotically flat black hole, so no P, this is sort of known as a Christodoulou-Ruffini mass formula. So now we have that if we take, for example, dm by ds, that should give us p, t, sorry. So I have to fix q and p. So if I unpick this and replace again s by r plus, I get back to the original formula that I had for t. So I've just checked that this whole process works. And so once you find these sort of integration expressions or these chemical expressions, it's actually easier to derive sort of quantitative results for the phases of the black hole. So here, for example, so if I look at the Gibbs free energy, which would be this enthalpy minus Ts, so if I plot this g as a function of t now, because I've this Legendre transformation takes me from s as my charge to t as my charge. This is the type of plot that I get. So if I track this through from my plot over here, the red one. So from this perspective, on the left here in the middle board, as R plus approached Q, my temperature went to zero. And so that's saying that here, my temperature goes to zero. And then as I increase T, my free energy increases. But then I hit, so if I put the sketch here, that was R plus and T, just to sort of keep in mind what's going on. So this is a relatively small black hole. So initially my temperature increases, but then it reaches this maximum here, so at point one, if you like, and then T starts to decrease. So this is point two. And then I reach this turning point here, and then T increases again, and it increases without limit, but the free energy drops. So this is a sort of characteristic swallowtail. And so if you sort of take this plot and you gradually increase P, you see the swallowtail shrinking until it disappears. So for large P, you simply get this type of behavior. So I feel I ought to at least say something about rotation. So we've seen the Kerr black hole, so some of this is familiar. So what we called previously delta is really just r squared f. So what changes when you add a cosmological constant is that you get a little extra function of theta here. And in addition, you have this constant here. Now, you could make that arbitrary, but so what you want when you've got a geometry is you set up a chart, and if you're going to be comparing families of solution, you need to have like the same coordinates. You can't sort of have your coordinates kind of running all over the place. And so if you fix the coordinate range of phi, then that constant there, that capital Xi, has to be 1 minus a squared on L squared for the axes to be regular. So just what's interesting or different, just to point out the differences with asymptotically flat Kerr. So as R tends to infinity, so one of the differences with asymptotically flat space times is that, so an asymptotically flat space time has a null infinity. ADS has a time-like infinity. So remember, ADS infinity is time-like. So if I look to see what GT phi does, so I just pick out the cross terms of each of these squares. So only this first term contributes, and it's blowing up like R squared. So that, maybe that's not entirely surprising, but it's not what happens in asymptotically flat space. So now if I look at what happens to G phi phi, so that's this piece here. So I've got a 1 over xi squared. Then I've got This is dominated by r squared, so I've got r to the fourth. But then sigma is dominated by r squared, so that leaves me with an r squared sine squared theta. And then I've got my g of theta there. But I've also got a d phi squared coming from here with, again, an r squared leading piece. And so these two combine together to give me just a 1 over xi. So if I ask what is my rotation, my local rotation, then I actually don't get 0. So what this means is that in ADS, the boundary is rotating. So that's one difference with asymptotically flat space-time. And then another difference is that, you know, normally in the Kerr metric, you've only got one bound on A, which comes from extremality. So there's, just like with the charge, the Reissner-Nordström black hole, there are two horizons, and you've got sort of like m plus or minus the square root of m squared minus a squared. So as A goes to m, the two horizons merge. That's your extremal limit. That's your bound on A. Here, we have a different bound on A given by this xi. We can't let that become negative. So these are two distinct differences with our normal Kerr black hole. We've kind of got an additional restriction on our rotation. And really, that kind of comes from this boundary rotation. If you try and spin up the black hole too fast, it means the boundary is kind of spinning, and it can't, your boundary can't rotate faster than the speed of light. So that's where that's coming from. And just to finish the thought, that obviously if your boundary is rotating, that impacts on your thermodynamic parameters. And so just to note that I've got a sign wrong somewhere with the rotation of infinity. So that's just really for completeness, giving you what the thermodynamic parameters are. So before finishing, I just want to set up for the next lecture. Just again, you know, this has all been sort of discussing thermodynamics and sort of talking about it like it's real, yeah? So why do we sort of believe, if you like, these thermodynamic arguments? So let's look at higher dimensional solutions. And what I just want to finish with is a thought about what thermodynamics tells you about stability of higher dimensional solutions. So I'm going to look at a black string in five dimensions. So this is really just Schwarzschild cross R. So all I do is I take my Schwarzschild metric, so this over here, and I just add a flat extra dimension. That's a solution to the Einstein equations. No lambda now. So my horizon looks like this. We've got some length for the length of the extra dimension. I've got some horizon. And G's have made a reappearance here. So my G4 is G5 on L. And my R4 is 2G5M on L. So the mass of the cylinder is really just related to the sort of four-dimensional R4 times the length. So if it's longer, then the mass goes up, okay? So I'm measuring mass kind of asymptotically here. My entropy is the area of the horizon, so that's 4 pi r4 squared times L, that's my overall area, and then I divide by 4g5, and this is 4 pi g4 m squared. So that is telling me how the entropy depends on the mass here. Whereas a 5D black hole A 5D black hole is just the spherically symmetric solution in five dimensions. And here, R5 squared, so the mass is related to the fall-off, the asymptotic fall-off, is 16 pi gm over 3 times the area of the 3-sphere. And so here, let me just quickly use the backboard here. So the mass of the black hole just inverting that gives me the mass in terms of the horizon radius. So the mass goes like the square of the horizon radius. And the entropy is going to go like the cube. So that's just the area of the horizon. So now what I want to do is just to compare the entropy of these two different solutions, but I have to compare like with like. So I have to compare them at the same mass. So I just peel off the expressions that I just calculated there. I've just decided what the entropy is in terms of the mass, and I also wrote down what the entropy of the black string was in terms of the mass. But then, of course, I know that G4 is equal to G5 on L, and so I can do some various cancellations here. So I get a sort of constant factor out here. So you can sort of see that that G5 goes with one with a G5 here, so I'm left with a root of G5, which is a root of G4 on L. And so you can see sort of pi's floating all over the place. And so what this indicates is that for L bigger than 27 pi on 8 G4m, that the black hole is actually preferred. So that's a completely thermodynamic argument, comparing two solutions. And so what this would indicate is that if we actually just look at these solutions in general relativity, then you ought to see an instability in the black string solution. And so we'll sort of talk a bit next time about perturbation theory in GR, and at least if not deriving it exactly, giving the signposts along the argument that indeed there is a instability in classical general relativity that onsets pretty much at that sort of scale, that tells you that a black string will essentially start to collapse into a load of black holes.